This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to the Wheelhouse.
You can see the confidence build day by day, and there is an electricity to his personality on the field that's really hard to look away from.
Starring Jerry DePoto.
And Jerry DePoto to the plate with a 2-2 pitch to Alex. Swing and a miss. He struck him out on the fastball.
With Aaron Goldsmith.
And now chapter three is, he's a real ball player. He's an impactful player. He can do a ton for your team, and this is a guy that can really help to solidify a big league lineup.
And Gary Hill Jr.
He seems along those lines where he wants to be great and does everything possible to go get it.
It's time for the Wheelhouse. Here's Aaron.
Welcome to another episode of the Wheelhouse Podcast. I'm Mariners broadcaster Aaron Goldsmith, joined as always by my good friend Gary Hill. G-Man, good to be with you, man.
It's great to be here.
Happiest guy in the ballpark every time. Jerry, it's a tough act to follow, man.
I can't possibly be as happy as Gary, but I'm working on it.
You know, I actually had somebody say to me, hey, I saw the podcast on Rude Sports. I said, oh, great. I'm glad you caught it. And he said, yeah, I just love when Gary says hi at the start of the show. And I said, really? Because that's actually, I think it's kind of uphill from there. But they thought that was downhill from there. They thought that was the apex of it. Just the natural joy and enthusiasm that Gary has for the pod.
Did you watch Welcome Back, Cotter, while you were a kid?
Can I tell you, I have no idea what those words are that you just said.
Oh, my God.
What?
This is...
You don't know Welcome Back, Cotter?
I mean, I'm 2-on-1 right now, but I'm just being honest.
Wow. It was a TV show in the 70s. It was... Yeah. It was great. Maybe reruns one day, coming home.
Okay, so I'm going to... Well, is that Cotter with a C?
With a K. Cotter with a K.
Eric with a C.
Yeah, Eric with a C. Cotter with a K. Great theme song.
Oh, okay.
There's no story now.
I've ruined something else. My apologies. I do have some... Before we get into it, right, because we got stuff, as always, here on the house. You saw the Field of Dreams game, I'm sure, or parts of it.
I did.
All right, which was one of the great moments in regular season baseball history, I think, at least for broadcast television in recent memory. But it brought on this very stern debate, a la Field of Dreams, of course, and that is, Jerry, do you say or did you say growing up, you want to play catch? Or do you say you want to have a catch? I mean, this became very controversial.
I always said, you want to have a catch.
Oh, man. Gare?
Play catch.
I mean, it's funny because the people who say have a catch, it's like there's another way to say it, right?
I always had catches.
Of course you did. Yeah, I've always just played catch. But yeah. But is that because of the movie?
No.
No.
It predates
the movie. Yeah.
You know? My dad commuted. We lived in central New Jersey, Toms River, New Jersey, and my dad commuted back and forth by train to work. He worked in Manhattan for a number of years. So he had a 2-hour train ride every day to go and then 2 hours coming back. And he'd come home in the summer, and there was still some sunlight, and I would say to him every night when he got home, Dad, do you want to have a catch? So
Is it an East Coast thing? Could that be?
Maybe.
Apparently Costner, like, fought against the phrase have a catch. So I heard him discuss when he went through the media gauntlet prior to the Field of Dreams game. But the screenwriter was like adamant it's have a catch. And Costner talked about how awkward it was for him to say that because he was of the play catch camp.
Yeah, I was of the have a catch.
You know, hey, tomato, tomato.
So also, this just to throw in there to make it even more nostalgic. I was with the Colorado Rockies it was actually maybe my final healthy spring as a player. So this is 1999, I believe it was 1999, and Kevin Costner was filming The Postman, in Tucson, Arizona, was where they did a large majority of the filming for the movie. And he spent a week in camp with us.
Really?
Like playing baseball with the Rockies. And he has real baseball skills. Where typically at that time you would have players or celebrities roll through major league camps. Some would you know, actually play. Garth Brooks would play in real major league spring training games. I'll bet you Garth Brooks probably had 50 at-bats in major league spring training games in the 90s. Yeah. And Kevin Costner spent a week with us in camp while he was filming. He would come over in the mornings, go through the workouts, take batting practice, and then leave and go do whatever actors do on site. But yeah, we got to spend a week with him in a Rockies camp. It's pretty cool.
Very cool.
We got to get Aaron into a game. I want to see first a fastball around 97, and
easy.
Then a wicked slider from a righty against Aaron. That's what I want to see.
So
yeah.
My very first at bat as a professional player. Now, mind you, I hit as a high schooler. And I could hit as a high schooler.
Yeah, that's what every pitcher says. We can go ahead.
But I hit as a high schooler, and then I went off to college, signed to play pro ball, spent 4 years in the minor leagues, went through another 2 years with an American League club before interleague. So it had been north of 10 years since I had a bat in my hand that wasn't a fungo hitting something soft to an infielder as a minor leaguer, you know, doing one-arm wallpaper hanger duty. So I hadn't hit. I get to spring training after I'd been traded to the Mets, and I've got my own bats with my name on them. I think that's really cool. And I get in the cage, and I'm hitting off of the pitching machine. I'm thinking, this isn't so bad. And this was in the shortened spring of 1995, where, you had 3 weeks to get ready. And, we had a number of pitchers that had been acquired from American League teams that year. Myself, Dave Malicki, Doug Henry, there were a handful. And Dallas Green, our then manager, decided that we had to experience at bats before the season started. So we're playing the Dodgers one night in Port St. Lucie, and Todd Worrell is pitching for the Dodgers. And for some reason, he chooses this to be my opportunity to get in at bat. And I go up to face Todd Worrell, and the first pitch he throws me is an upper 90s fastball, because at that time, not a lot of guys threw that hard. And he threw an upper 90s fastball, and I turned around to the umpire, and I said, oh, my God. I was terrified. I thought that there's no chance. I just closed my eyes. I swung at the next one, and I hit a fly ball. I flew
out.
Did?
Yeah. All right, hey, that's something, man.
And then I didn't get a hit for many years after
that. Why we are on the subject of shall we call it like baseball vernacular? I do think this is a good time, since you are a man of the game, to clear up two other, I think, very controversial phrases. Are we game for this? This is not Stump JD, all right? We're actually relying on you to kind of help set a trend here. If 9 batters hit in one inning, is that batting around, or does it need to have the 10th, in your estimation, to bat around?
No, I think it's the 9. The 9 and you bat around.
Gary, do you have a thought on this?
Wait, I need some clarification.
Okay,
here.
So 9...
You need the 10th batter to come up?
Do you need the 10th batter of an inning to bat around? Or just
when
send
the,
9?
When the 9th is batting, is that batting around?
That's the question.
Or did you just exhaust the 9-man lineup? I think you batted around.
Gary, do you have...
You need the 10th to come up.
See, you know what's interesting about that? I've always been a 10th guy, but I recently saw a visualization of batting around, because this was so controversial, and all they did was they just drew a circle with 9 men, and the 9th person completed the circle. It completes the lineup, right?
Batting around.
And I saw that, and I thought, oh my gosh.
This makes sense to me.
This does make sense. That I can buy as batting around.
Because
everyone did bat.
So you want it to be like the S that just keeps. It's just a line.
I'm more on the 9-man batting around bandwagon than I ever have been. Gary, do you want to join me? We'll talk about this later.
I mean, this is important.
It's heavy.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Everybody batted.
Everybody batted. See? I know.
Or you can just say that and skip the whole thing. Everybody batted.
It's like saying a no-hitter without saying a no-hitter. Like, nobody's gotten a hit yet.
I didn't say anything.
Yeah, no, I didn't say no-hitter. I just said nobody's had a hit. Okay, final one. This, I think, is maybe the most controversial. If a pitcher, let's just cherry pick a number, a pitcher faces six batters in an inning.
Oh, I know.
You know where I'm going.
Yeah.
And he strikes out three of them. Did he strike out the side? Because some people will argue that you only strike out the side if it's a 1-2-3 inning.
I would not be one of those people. Three strikeouts, you struck out the side. See, all of the outs were recorded by strikeout.
Okay, I'm of that same camp. I think you take it the next step further. You say he struck out the side in order if it's a 1-2-3 inning. Because my argument to that would say, if you get a ground ball out on the, let's say, sixth batter to end the inning, then you would say he grounds out to retire the side.
Yes.
Gary?
So, yeah, you are both technically correct on this.
Oh, here we go.
But what I will say as a play-by-play person, when you say struck out the side, it should have some meaning to it.
Well, it does. You recorded all three outs via the strikeout.
Right,
that means something.
You could also give up six runs in between the three strikeouts.
But.
And so you can't say technically, hey, he struck out the side.
Yeah, but
his team is down by 10, but he struck out the side. So I only use strike out the side when it's meaningful and he literally struck out the side with nothing else happening. So while you're technically correct, I do not use it that way.
Gary doesn't use it that way.
I don't.
I can tell you, if you strike out all three hitters in a major league lineup in an inning, first of all, if you do that and give up six runs, you probably just became the first of your kind. If you strike out all three hitters in a major league inning, you just did something meaningful. They're the best hitters in the world.
What counts is your K per nine, okay? And your K per nine just got better.
Seemingly, unless you're Randy Johnson.
Right. Now, your ERA might have just completely inflated. But, you know, Gary, I see your point, but I do enjoy the humor of saying in those rare instances where a guy gives up a six spot, but punches out three, saying he strikes out the side while giving up six runs. Like, I think there is some comedic value to that.
Sure there is.
You know, that somebody would pick up on. I'll be honest. I don't think Jerry was as emphatic about anything more than striking out the side.
Striking out the side is a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
All right. Well, we're out of time.
but we cleared up a lot of nuance.
All of baseball fans across the world are grateful for our efforts here. All right.
I will say that Paul Sewald in Houston, now that was striking out the side.
Yes, it is.
Well, I mean.
But did he?
See, now here's Gary. This technicality, he's double backing on his technicalities. You know, that sounds like a classic G-man move to me.
Paul Sewald has had multiple strikeout the side moments this year. That was magical. The job that he did, it was a Houdini act against really good hitters. And, and you know, to do that at that moment in time when the game is just hanging in the balance, there's not to segue out of baseball technicalities, but you know, I do think that job, you know, what Paul did, even what Joe Smith did earlier in the game, inheriting runners at second and third and coming up with big strikeouts against really good hitters, that's an amazing thing and allowed us to salvage a game and get out of that, really to finish that the first six games of that road trip 4-2 instead of 3-3.
Well, since our nonsense has taken us into this path, let's run with it here. The pitching for the Mariners in the month of August has been exceptional. It's been among the very best in all of the majors, whether you're talking about the rotation or the bullpen. The bullpen has been an anchor all season long. What is it that you're seeing right now from either unit, relievers or starters, that has led to the success in the month of August?
Well, you know, prior to the ninth inning of the third game of the Texas series in Texas, our pitching was the best in the league up until that point. And I think the catalyst had been strike one. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that we have pounded for years and our pitchers have really taken to heart. And it's something that we're doing a remarkable job of being consistent with from the starters to the relievers. And I think our relievers have taken it to another level and that they just stopped walking people. And, you know, they were going multiple games without walking, mm-hmm. you know, opposing hitters in a game. And when you when you constantly attack the strike zone with the kind of stuff that a lot of these guys have, good things happen. And, you know, as a result, we were suppressing runs and we were giving our team a chance to win every game. And we were doing that a fair bit, despite the fact that our offense was really not operating on, you know, or hitting on all cylinders for a while there. And, you know, I think it was a remarkable run. You know, obviously we ran into it a little bit when we got to Houston, but, you know, the recipe of going out and hammering the strike zone on 0-0 and winning your 1-1s. That's been the secret sauce, is, you know, when you can go 0-1 or 1-2 as a pitching staff, what you do to the hitter is amazing. And it doesn't matter how good the hitters are. It is really hard to hit in those counts in the big leagues.
So how much of that is physical stuff and how much of it is mindset? Because you can tell a guy, throw it in this box, right? Throw it in the strike zone. But it's obviously not that easy, or more guys would do it. So how do you kind of balance the mindset versus the physical ability to do that?
For us, it's creating a constant with the mindset. You know, I pitched for a lot of years, and people suggested to me through the years that throwing strikes, you know, could help. You know, it would be a very important element to success. But nobody ever drove it day after day after day. And, I know Woody and Trent drive it day after day. Scott drives it day after day. Andy and Max Wiener in our minor league system, they drive it. And at the very youngest stages of their careers, they understand if we do these two things, we throw strike one and we win our 1-1s, good things are going to happen. And then lo and behold, they do. And I think our very best month in 0-0s and 1-1s was August, until we got to Houston. And then we came off the rails a little bit. Those are the two key counts for us. And if you establish that as this is what we do, and you saw it with Tyler Anderson on the Sunday game in Houston. He went out, I think he was 80% first pitch strikes. You've seen it with Marco. Marco's resurgence in August is from throwing strike one and winning his 1-1s. He's always been able to do that. Now that he's doing it again, you know, he turned back into the Marco that we'd watched for the 3 years prior.
Chris Flexen is the primary example of this.
100%.
And the success he's had this season.
And that's what Flex does. He goes out and he throws strike one, and then he wins the 1-1s, and he doesn't give up free bases. You know, when we don't have a big overpowering strikeout starting staff, so it's critical for us that we suppress base runners by forcing them to hit their way on. Because you know what's not easy to do is get hits. It's really not that easy to get hits in the big leagues. At least Ted Williams once told me that was the case. But, you know, I think our starters do a wonderful job of going and attacking the strike zone and forcing the opponent to beat them by hitting their way on. And sometimes they will, but most of the time they won't.
I've got a specific question about somebody that we've loved watching pitch this year and has been everything that we hope for and more, I think it's fair to say, and that is Logan Gilbert. We know Logan is fastball heavy, loves the heater, and he especially loves the fastball first time through the order, right? I mean, it's not a surprise to see Logan throw north of 70% fastball to the first nine batters. Is that a problem against certain lineups? Like, we saw him against the Blue Jays, which is an exceptional fastball hitting team, right? So it's strength on strength. And Logan stuck with his strength, and Blue Jays stuck with theirs, hitting the fastball. Is that something that he can stay with going forward in his career? Does he have to pick his lineups to change his plan? It's a great fastball, but there are also some great fastball hitting teams. How do you view that, wanting him to stick with the strength, but also knowing at times that you gotta hit your spot against some teams like we saw against the Blue Jays?
So I do think that it is something Logan sticks with. It's who he is. You know, he is all about the fastball quality. And he's 93 to 98. But it plays much, much harder than that. And, you know, it's a very deceptive ride on his fastball. As a general rule, when Logan's on, I don't care who's in the box. If he's elevating his fastball and he's getting that ride at the top of the zone, no one's really going to do much with it. But as you go through the league, you know, I'm going to quote Nuke LaLoosh here. You know, his response to Kevin Costner when pressed with, you know, we got to throw something different than the fastball here. Yeah, and he said, I'm going to announce my presence with authority. They haven't seen my fastball yet. And if you recall, that's when Costner actually put down, you know,
right.
Hey, a fastball's coming. Speak well of me. That great line. You know, Logan has to find out who he can do it to and who he can't, because when your fastball is that special and you're that confident in it, any one of us could say to him, hey, you can't throw your fastball to so-and-so. And his first reaction, as it should be, is, oh, yeah, watch. And, you know, and he's learning. And, you know, there is, it's like a tennis match, especially over a long career. You know, you serve, they return the serve. Now he's got to figure out how to create a different look with his next serve. And I think you saw that in his outing against the Astros. It wasn't a successful start, but he threw a lot of secondary stuff. He started using his other weapons. And he has to develop the confidence in doing that, because when you are facing a high contact team that hits the fastball well, like the Astros do, you have to have another trick in the bag. And we're confident that Logan's going to pick that up, but he has to learn that going through the first time. It's not something you can read in a book.
When you look at Logan and what he's experienced lately facing the Blue Jays, Yankees in Yankee Stadium, the Astros at Minute Maid Park with that offense, for a young pitcher, what kind of value do you put on those experiences for a guy who's, you know, just 16, 17 starts into his career?
He's 24 years old. We plan on him pitching, you know, in really high leverage spots against really good teams in cold months of the year for a long time. And, you know, in order to feel comfortable in doing that, you have to experience it. And, you know, Logan is always going to stay mentally focused. Mm-hmm. And even as he's gone through a bit of a lull in terms of the outcomes, he has not backed off his willingness to attack the strike zone. And for the most part, even while he struggled with some of the feel of his secondary stuff, like he did maybe against Tampa in Tampa, you know, like he did against Houston, in those instances, when he just has, you know, the fastball, he has to be able to hit all of the locations in the strike zone, because there's going to be days where he just don't have that great feel for your secondary stuff. But he has enough of a special fastball that if he just remembers it's all about hitting the different areas of quadrants of the strike zone, he can still go out and roll through and give you a chance to win, like he did in Tampa. You know, I mean, he got us to the sixth inning of that game against a really good offense simply by pitching with his fastball, and he didn't have as good fastball command, so he had to create different looks. And he has so many different ways to win, and the experiences that he's gaining right now against the big boys in their home during a playoff race is invaluable to us, like it is for a lot of the other guys as well.
How do you define a stress pitch?
The anxiety I'm feeling before I throw it.
I mean, we hear,
or someone else throws it.
We it's something we talk about somewhat often on the broadcast, right? And we hear Scott reference it, and I feel like it's typically something that even the viewer can kind of recognize, right? But for somebody who's been there on the mound, there must be certain instances where a 20 pitch inning feels a lot more taxing than another 20 pitch inning, or you can cherry pick whatever number you want. But when you're watching the game and you know that this pitcher has X number of pitches on his pitch count today when he takes the mound, when he has a whatever number of pitch inning it is, but there's traffic and it's against batters A, B, and C, and now it's starting to affect how long he's going to be out there for the rest of the day. Like walk us through a little bit some of those situations, how Scott might be deciphering, this is going to cut his day short by an inning, or maybe it won't because it was a longer inning, but man, it wasn't that stressful for whatever reason.
So they're not all pitches are created the same. And usually it does have something to do with the amount of traffic that's on base. Like, for instance, and I can't tell you how many pitches Paul Sewald threw during his inning on this past Sunday's game against Houston, but they were high stress pitches. You know, he was in the middle of it. You know, the when Johan Ramirez comes in with the bases loaded to face Altuve and Brantley with the game in the balance, those are high stress pitches. So it's some combination of the anxiety that most humans feel when you're in the, you know, tight situations and you have to perform. You know, when you go out to take the ball in those innings and you realize that there is no backup plan, either you're going to get it done or we're probably going to lose this game. And I think with the starting pitchers, especially in the early innings, you know, if in the first couple of innings of the game, you've got a lot of traffic in the first couple of innings and, you know, you're 40, 45 pitches in the first two, maybe like Yusei was in this past Saturday's game or Friday's game against the Astros, you know, and in that instance, those early, you know, stress pitches, when you're pitching with constant men on base and you're behind in counts, when you're behind in counts, the stress that you're putting on yourself to try to hit those, you know, precise spots is it, you, now not only are you stressing yourself physically, but you're stressing yourself mentally, you know, because no one's going to hit the head of the needle every time you throw a pitch, but that's the space you're forcing yourself into. And I don't think Logan ever really goes there. You know, I think Logan always focuses on the big strike zone, and he knows that when he needs to, he can, like Flex, he can just come back in and start hammering the big part of the strike zone as long as he elevates it, and he can get back into counts. So his stress might be a little different than, say, Yusei's stress, which might be a very, very different from the guys who are pitching near the end of the game. Because when you are brought in with someone else's runners on and it's all on the line, there's your heart's just beating a little bit faster, your body's doing things that it doesn't naturally do, and your mind is working overtime. And when all those things start coming together, you see the smoke coming out of the ears. That, all right, the high stress is happening. It's right now.
Ty France has been one of the most productive hitters in the American League. I mean, where do you want to start the timeline, right? The beginning of the second half, you want to go back to the early part of July till now. You can tell he is, I don't know, he's not probably fully healthy. I don't know who is fully healthy at this time of the season, but he seems to be very well past the forearm issue that put him on the IL earlier this year. This is the best version of Ty France, and it, I don't know, Jerry, what do you think? It's the best version of any Mariners hitter we've seen all year, maybe? I mean, that's a big statement, but I mean, he's doing everything and more that you could have possibly hoped for.
Maybe better than we've seen in multiple years. You know, it's been that good. And I, Ty, when we acquired Ty from the Padres, and that might be the start of his timeline because he's really been quite good since the day he showed up in a Mariners uniform. And, you know, and it's only gotten more and more pronounced because I think now we're seeing not just the hitability that he brings to the table or to the batter's box every time he steps in it. You know, we're seeing power start to manifest itself. He's always been able to take his walk. The hit by pitch is part of his offensive skill set. You know, and there are guys that just have that part of their skill set.
I mean, is that really? Would a scout really say that?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, no. Proza, he gets drilled often. And like 20 times.
Don Baylor, Craig Biggio, sure. Jason Kendall, you know, they all had it. You know, Ron Hunt, these guys, they just get hit. And when you get hit as frequently as they do, it does count. You're on base. And, you know, but I do think that Ty's, you know, he is starting to develop a sense, at least it looks this way from where I sit. And Scott and I have talked about it quite a bit. He's starting to develop a sense for what the team needs him to do in a moment. And I don't want to say it's as simple as throwing on the power switch or throwing on the, I better get hit pitch, you know, or switch. He does what the team needs. When it's time to get a guy over, when it's time to do the simple thing, you know, Edgar will tell you that through the years, where you go to drive in your runs is in the middle of the field. You know, the go to the big part of the field, start in right center field and move that way. That's what Ty does. When he's in those moments, he hits like hitters who played years and years ago. There's some throwback in the way Ty does it. And, you know, I think what he's doing presently is reflective of the fact that he's healthy after having gone through a stretch where he was probably playing at less than, you know, right. I don't even want to say it's 100% because he's not 100% now. None of them are. But he was considerably less than 100% and he was still contributing. And what he's doing now is just driving our offense in some way. It's been so fun to watch.
I'm glad you mentioned Ron Hunt, who has hit 50 times in one season.
Crazy, right?
I think it's the best.
Really?
To your point, when you look at Ty France, who's now been a Mariner for just over 140 games at this point, in that stretch, his average is just about 300, is on base over 360, about 20 home runs, over 30 doubles. It's a season, essentially a season's worth of production. That is really, really productive for a guy who sometimes I think we get fooled into like, he's a veteran. He's been around forever. He's still really young, essentially, in his
26.
Major league career.
He's got a year plus of major league service. He's 26 years old. You know, Ty is, when we acquired him, we really believed that he could do these things offensively. You know, and he's doing these things while growing into a heck of a first baseman. The defense he's played has been remarkable. And he had a tough act to follow in Evan White, but it's has been awesome defensively. He's doing those things. He's put up, you know, let's call it something in the neighborhood of 4 wins above replacement and something reflecting a full season while playing first base, second base, third base, roughly wherever we needed him to play. And I think what he does offensively, the consistency with which he does it, and I think he's only getting better. It's we've seen it within, you know, this season, but even just since he's joined us, you know, he's grown in his strike zone management. Mm. He's grown in his ability to get to his power. He's always had the power, you know, now he's getting to it with more frequency. And I don't think that's going to change because he really thinks about what he's doing in the batter's box. And he's got great rhythm. That helps.
So we hear, Scott, and you referenced this earlier, the mantra of dominate the zone. And I think so oftentimes we think of it strictly from the pitcher's side of things. But it's obviously very applicable for the hitters. And when you look at some of the players that you have acquired, guys like Crawford stand out, France certainly, Abraham Toro, guys who are walking like probably at least around league average rates, but the strikeout rate, the swing and miss is noticeably below, more contact guys. Not that they're not hitting for power as well, but they put the ball in play. I mean, on a nightly basis, you know that you have those three at least, and I could be leaving somebody out as a regular, but those stand out, really stand out. I mean, is the pendulum kind of shifting in this regard, like the value of that type of a hitter in this swing and miss environment that we've seen kind of for years now at this point? Like, the value of that player has increased as a result to counterbalance the whiffs that a lot of lineups have for the majority, it seems like, or at least half of their hitters.
Well, and we have been chief among them for a number of years where we strike out a lot. And that's something of a byproduct of developing young players in the big leagues. It's something of, you know, for a period, especially 2019, we had a lot of high power hitters with a lot of strikeout in their game. But when you watch the best teams in the league, and I'll point to teams like the Houston Astros, like the New York Yankees, those lineups that just keep on coming, even the Toronto Blue Jays present day, mm-hmm. you know, The guys in the middle of their lineup don't strike out. There's by the standards of that we consider strikeouts today, you know, where 25-30% is an acceptable rate for middle of the order power hitters. You know, you go back and you look through in the old days, you know, when you're looking back through the lens at the Hank Aarons and the Willie Mays and, you know, Mickey Mantle, who's among the highest strikeout totals of all time. Those guys didn't really strike out very much by the same standards that we accept today. And guys like JP and Toro and Ty France, when you have the opportunity to turn base runners into runs, like Michael Brantley and Jose Altuve and Carlos Correa, they put the ball in play. And when you put the ball in play, good things happen. And when you strike out in those moments, there is no chance really to score the run. But when you put the ball in play, and that's what these guys do, you know, I'll say this because we just finished not too long ago with the Blue Jays. Incredibly talented team, very entertaining offense to watch. And, you know, a former teammate of mine is over there now as a special consultant hitting coach, Dante Bichette. His son, Bo, is the shortstop. And for years, I watched Dante, who was a great hitter for a period of time in the 90s. And with two strikes, Dante, like George Brett, like Don Mattingly, they would spread out with two strikes, no stride, just hit with your hands and hit, you know, middle opposite field. Edgar Martinez comes to mind. And those guys don't strike out because they level out and they just try to fire a line drive out into right center. And it's Frank Thomas hit that way. And these guys who can do it with huge power, that's where the runs score, is when you get in the middle of those lineups and those guys are willing to check down to a two-strike approach, which is a natural thing for Ty and Toro and JP.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on this too, because I feel like directly tied to that is swinging at strikes. Because you look at some of the teams you just referenced, the teams that don't swing outside the zone. you look at the teams that don't swing outside the zone, and we're talking about the Astros, the Giants, the Yankees. It doesn't seem like a coincidence we're talking about some of the best offenses in baseball.
There's no question. And like, I will say this, you could throw the A's in there. Yeah. They just don't chase. And, you know, we have elevated ourselves into that stratosphere. We have not yet matured in our ability to kind of turn that into consistent offense or consistent runs the way those teams have. Yeah. But we are by far the youngest of them. We're starting to do things that are really interesting from, you know, an under the hood inspection. Our guys do force you to throw it in the strike zone. And we have become very good at grinding at the end of games. We also have some young hitters that are very liberal with, you know, the stretching the strike zone and chasing outside of it. And once we rope that group in and we're able to do those things, that's how long lineups happen, is when you are forcing teams to throw. And we saw it over the course of the weekend series with the Astros. How many 8, 9, 10 pitch at bats did we see versus Logan, versus Tyler Anderson, or even versus Yusei? There's long at bats where they wouldn't go away. And it's not simply because they're out there thinking, I don't want to strike out. They're forcing you into the strike zone. And when they force you into the strike zone, they clip it, they hit a foul ball. The next thing you know, the starting pitcher has 70 pitches in the fourth inning, and you're going to get into the softest part of that pitching staff, which is, generally speaking, when you're behind in a game and the first one or two guys that come out of the bullpen are likely to be the guys that are most susceptible to good lineups really getting. And that's the plan, is drive into that bullpen as soon as you can.
And to your point too, you've moved into the top 10.
Yeah, we've preached it and stressed it, because all you have to do, it's like a self-selecting class. If I want to talk about the best, you know, pitchers of all time, and I categorize it in any way, you know, swing and miss, it's strike one, who's the best at winning 1-1s. If you take those categories and just sort the best pitchers that you're ever going to see, they all gravitate to the top of the list. You know, someone once said, you know, the cream rises to the top. That they do. And the best teams, when you sort by that data, they all rise to the top. So the easiest way for us to learn how to be one of those teams is to start doing those things that the great teams do. Don't just go out and let it hang out and you know, play a freewheeling game. Focus on what you're doing, because as 24, 25, 26 year olds, we have a chance to help these. We're starting it when they're 16 and 18. You know, we have a chance to develop the mentality to do the things that championship teams do, and to start doing it early.
I do want to take a quick detour down on the farm. Some Mariners fans might remember he was a closer for the Mariners for a very brief period of time, maybe not an officially designated closer, but he often pitched the ninth with a 3-run lead or less. Taylor Williams. Taylor Williams was here for a short period of time, traded to the Padres, like on the same day maybe as the Nola deal, or like within hours of the Nola deal?
I think
deal?
it was a day or so okay. later, but like, it was pretty fast.
Yeah, the Nola deal, like that's the trade with the Padres that Ty France and many others come over in, but people forget that Taylor Williams was traded to San Diego as well. Matt Brash was not announced at the time that Brash was coming over, but was announced somewhat soon thereafter. And Matt Brash is just punching tickets left and right. He's in Double A now. And that's a stacked rotation with some big headline names that have been on the cover of Baseball America recently. And yet Brash is the one who is, I don't know, maybe standing out the most, which is maybe a bold statement. What can you tell us about Matt Brash, what he's doing, and what you made of it?
He's filthy, is in a word. He, you know, Matt was an under the radar draftee. I want the Padres took him in 2019 out of Niagara. We didn't even see him as an amateur, you know, but we had video footage, and imagine that we, you know, somehow we missed the under the radar guy at Niagara. But he, you know, he had a really interesting, you know, data set. Coming out of the draft, we're like, all right, they got one. They're like, this guy has a super high spin rate. There's real velocity there. He's been up to, 100, 101 miles an hour. Generally will sit around 97 with his fastball, and he holds the velocity. He's got the high spin on the breaking ball. He also has the ability to back up a changeup. He has a starter's repertoire with a really high, a pretty aggressive delivery. And, when people look at Matt, your general assessment is, that's really good stuff. He probably winds up in a bullpen because he's so, here I come. It was passed on to me that our scout that was in to see him in his most recent Double-A outing, sent a text that referenced the outing as, oh my God, this was seven innings of fury. because it just didn't stop. It was 97-98 in the first inning, and it's 97-98 in the seventh inning. And he has the physical stuff and the ability to hold it that starters have. And you could draw comparisons to other pitchers that have that high level stuff and the high, volatility type delivery. That adds a bit of deception and a bit of, here I am on the mound. And Matt's been, he's been awesome really since we started. His strike throwing, his command have both improved exponentially, even just since his promotion to Double-A. And the stuff is off the charts good, especially the slider, which on a scale of 100, 100 being average, we grade pitches out at 100 based on their physical data. The effects on the ball, the spin, the velocity and all those things, his slider grades out as a 190. It's an exceptional pitch, and he does that, and he has fastball velocity, and he can back it up, and now he's developing command. And whether he winds up in a rotation or in a bullpen, it's probably not going to be too long before we see him, and we're really excited about what comes.
I'm very curious about the 190 grade slider. Is there a pitcher in the org that has graded out 200 on anything?
No. Now, we have not had a 200 pitch, and it doesn't really happen. You might have, because the pitches are graded on a daily basis and then, in aggregate. So you may have a day where a pitcher, pops off and he's got like a 220 change and you're like, oh my gosh, that's unbelievable. Matt has been able to sustain a slider in that 170, 190 range all year long. And if the way you reference that is this is somewhere between 70% and 90% better than the average slider, not than a bad slider, than the average slider.
Right.
That's pretty exceptional.
It's amazing. You mentioned he was under the radar at Niagara. I talked to Matt recently, and how he got to Niagara is amazing. Baseball is the greatest. He happened to be at a showcase, and he was playing shortstop, and a Niagara coach happened to be there and said, oh, he's got a really good arm. Do you want to just pitch for us and see what that looks like? And so he did, and here he is. I think it's incredible. Baseball's the greatest.
Yeah, he's incredibly talented. That whole rotation in Arkansas right now with, with Matt, I don't think people realize how good Levi Stout is. Now George Kirby and Emerson Hancock are there. Brandon Williamson got there a couple of months ago. It is a really talented group of guys, and really excited that they're now a phone call away. They're at the front door, and we're excited to see what comes next.
How are you approaching the minor league season? First of all, I'm embarrassed. I don't know this. Was there ever a decision made? Will the season extend further because it got off to a month late start, or will it clip at the normal time that it normally would? It'll just be essentially a slightly truncated season.
So at the AAA level, the AAA players are going to play through the major league schedule. Okay. At the minor league levels, the teams are, or at the Double-A and down levels, the teams are going to play through the second and in some cases third week of September. So much deeper than they typically do. And then we're going to have a playoff set up in each of the leagues for the two teams that finish 1 and 2 in their division. So right now, it bodes well for us having all of our minor leaguers play through into early October, which is ideal for us.
And how has the whole idea of, and we talked about this at the start of the season, with innings and minor league pitchers, especially those who, you know, didn't pitch at all last year, mapping it out, how is that going in kind of that spreadsheet of chaos to figure that out this year?
It's been chaotic. You know, fortunately for me, it's been chaotic for somebody else. But, you know, Max Wiener and Andy and our player development group do a phenomenal job. Trent Blank, who is actually our director overseeing pitching development in total, and works closely with Max and Andy on these things. They have set up targets for our pitchers, and some guys like Logan, you know, who did throw, you know, through last summer, though he wasn't building up huge inning totals. Similarly, Brandon Williamson, they were on more aggressive innings totals, where guys like Emerson and George were on something, you know, that was a little more conservative. And we've had to manage that. And we've also had to manage that, you know, pitching every fifth or sixth day, which we were doing the same thing with six-man rotations at all of our affiliates to preserve pitchers' health and to manage pitch count. And as a result, just like I think we've seen at the major league level, all of our minor league players are starting to really kind of they are starting to excel while other pitchers are starting to hit innings totals or get tired around the league. And our guys, I don't want to say we're fresh, but we are a little fresher as a result. And we think that there is great value in pitching through the end of the schedule, just making sure that we get them through pitching in September and you know, fingers crossed, pitching in October is a huge part of development.
We're going to wrap it up with a great Stump JD.
Is this about your garage door?
I actually got rid of my initial question and focused on my garage door. I was late today because of my garage door. I feel like the people need to know that. Okay, so Little League World Series going on, right? Now, there's all kinds of normal questions. You know, played in both. You know, no.
Go Eli Jones.
Yeah, this is. I do have to admit something besides my garage door. I did ask Gary yesterday, hey, have I asked Jerry this before? Because we've done, I mean, how many episodes are we into this thing, Gary? I mean, we're like, there's 70 plus,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
So, I mean, speaking of spreadsheets, I have to go back this winter and make a Stump JD spreadsheet.
Yeah, we're getting to that
point. And keep track of, I mean, I don't want to double up.
The wins, the losses, and the embarrassments.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a great idea.
We need stats, yeah.
Yeah, we do need stats. We need a winning percentage here. But more just like, have I asked this already? Gary initially thought that I did. Do you still feel that way?
You know, I initially thought so, but the answer leads me to think that...
Okay. Yeah. I don't... Gary scared me, but I don't think I've asked you this. All right, so Little League World Series going on. Jerry, there is, to my knowledge, one player who has won a Little League World Series and has won a Major League World Series. He is an active major leaguer.
Active major leaguer.
Yeah.
And he is the one player who has won a Little League World Series and a Major League World Series. Wow.
I mean, this is like...
And he's the only player in history to ever do this?
Now don't start questioning things, okay?
Well, I don't know.
just answer the question.
An active player.
He's an active player.
To have won the Little League World Series and the Major League World Series.
You've nailed it once again.
I don't know who it is.
I think hints are required here. Don't you think, Gary?
But I feel like this was the thing.
He's in the division.
He's in our division?
Yeah. He is in the Mariners division.
Wow. We have seen him a million times?
A million times.
A million times?
Yeah.
So we've seen this fellow.
He is from Venezuela.
Who has won a World Series in our division.
Yeah. No, I didn't say he won a World Series in our division, Jerry.
He won a World Series.
He won a World Series.
He currently plays in our division.
Period. He's in our division.
I'm going to go. Could it be Jose Altuve?
It could not be.
I'm just guessing.
I would say he is among the most underappreciated relievers in the game.
Fair.
Among the most underappreciated relievers.
Yeah. So you know he's not a closer.
Baseball. From Venezuela.
Yeah. He is in his 14th big league season.
Is it Yusmeiro Petit?
Yes!
Jerry!
It was amazing. Went straight for him. So I will say that when you first asked the question, I feel like somewhere along the way, and I'm not honed on my Little League World Series trivia.
That's why we're here.
But I was at one point, I thought Gary Sheffield had done that, had won a Little League World Series and a Major League World Series. And there were, I believe Jason Varitek might have done that and won the, or appeared in the college. He appeared in
Little League. All three.
Yeah, college and Major League World Series. But I thought Sheffield had done that.
Well, I can fact check Brian Kenny if you want me to. Yeah,
I digress. Well, oh, is this Brian Kenny?
Then I got to give BK credit. Not like I say BK like BK like Brian Kenny's outside the door or something.
Oh, you know? Now I believe it.
He's as dialed in as anyone. Yusmeiro Petit. All right. So when you traded for Yusmeiro, he didn't drop this. This is pre-World Series. That was the problem. He won it in 14 with the Giants.
No, Yusmeiro was when I was with the Diamondbacks, we traded for Yusmeiro Petit. At the time, he was with the Marlins.
So after his rookie year.
Yeah, we acquired him. Yusmeiro came up with the Mets, was traded to the Marlins, then made his way from the Marlins to the Diamondbacks. Okay. And it was only the beginning of what can only be referenced as a long journey that has resulted in Yusmeiro Petit being, you know, everything that you thought that he was going to be when you watched him pitch in Binghamton when he was in Double A with the Mets. He did. But he started doing it when he was 32, which was amazing. It's his feel to pitch, and apparently he was doing it when he was 12 for Venezuela, which I didn't know.
I have an update.
Oh, you do?
Gary Sheffield made it to the championship of the Little League World Series. They lost to Taiwan 4-3.
Because that's what everybody did. They lost to Taiwan.
He set the doubles record.
Wait.
Gary Sheffield.
Like the Little League World Series?
Little League World Series doubles record set by Gary Sheffield. It was just
this doesn't shock me. It's
was he wagging the bat then? Okay.
He was terrifying.
All right. I honestly feel much better now that Gary looked that up. Thank you, Gary. Because when Jerry starts questioning me on stuff, I mean, there's some things I'm pretty rock solid on, but
you were rock solid.
I gotta be honest. there's a 10% chance that just wasn't true at all. So, you know, which I think is kind of a hanging clause for Stump JD, if we can.
Yeah.
Well, you know, from week to week, possibly.
Yeah, we're probably mostly right on those, but
how about Jerry's performance there?
Yeah, that was good.
I mean, that's a really hard question. But wait, I think we filtered it down like two tiers and. And you weren't spraying answers. I mean, you...
Yeah, you honed in.
We have seen him a million times. Yeah. It's about as accurate as you could be.
That was accurate. Like
anytime at this point the Mariners play the A's and we don't see Petit pitch in that game, it's weird.
Yeah, it's very strange. Something is wrong. Yeah.
There's and for a guy that comes in and is not going to overpower you with velocity, the way he can make major league hitters just off center, the barrel of their bat is... pretty fascinating.
And pitch every day.
Every day.
Yeah. Jerry, fine work on Stump JD. I would chalk that up as a win for you.
Yeah.
Is there a middle column? Like a win with help?
I'm not going to count this one as a win.
Okay. Well, nevertheless, fine job. And Jerry, as always, we appreciate it, man. It's great being with you.
A lot of fun.